Welcome, everyone. Welcome to our third, I think, is this the third episode or fourth episode,
fourth episode
of Coffee with Centuro. I'm Siraj Tofi, and with me is Zain Ali and Ben Blackburn. And we just, yeah, we're busy talking about business news, not only the news, but what's been happening in the business around the world. So let me kick it off. Just a few key highlights that I've seen today. Did you guys see Jeff Bezos? Is becoming the first person worth $200 billion. Smidge south of $200 billion. Do you think he has problems? Well, like, does he lie awake at night on how to spend it, or how the tax he pays, or what is his male problems? Because didn't he give half of it away to his ex-wife, and he still has $200 billion? Is that right?
Yes.
Yeah.
And do you know that she became, I saw an article where it was the richest woman in the world, and she made the top 10. And as they kind of mention the woman's name, and then they say she made it in telecoms. And then the other one says her name, and she made it in mining or whatever. And then it goes, it's her name, divorce. She basically became one of the top 10 richest women in the world just from divorce. Anyway, that's not what we're here to speak about. But did you want to comment, Ben? Sorry.
Oh, I was just going to say, it doesn't surprise me with all the surges that's happening in the stock market at the moment. Tesla's flipping out and going sky high and all sorts of things. So I imagine if he's got a problem at rolling around in bed, it's what's going to happen when it all comes back down. I think there's the turmoil of what's happening at the moment. It's making stocks go all over the place, and at some point it'll flatten out. So it'll be interesting to see what happens there. That might be his only concern.
I mean, I think with Amazon, though, they're so ingrained in society now. They do everything, whether you're using Amazon Prime to watch videos, you're ordering things. The fact they've made it so you can get delivery next day. I mean, everyone's so reliant on them. I don't know if they will flatten. But the interesting thing with Bezos, what you're saying is, I don't know for sure, but around 12% of the company. So any kind of fluctuation in the share price, within a couple of days, he could go up in value by hundreds of millions or down by several million. So, and also that's another thing to bear in mind, it's stock. So it doesn't actually have that cash to hand, it's the value of the company, but it's still a lot of money.
It's still a lot of money. On a completely separate note, KFC, your not so friendly and healthy snack, is no longer finger licking good. Have you heard of that? Because of COVID, they're just good. They know they've dropped, after many, many years, they've dropped their payoff line from finger licking good to just it's good because of COVID. Who would have thought that KFC could also get affected by COVID, right?
Yeah, they've had some really excellent marketing during this. I think them and I think Burger King are also doing some really good stuff on different ads and playing off it and capturing people's attention. So it doesn't quite surprise me that they've taken that approach of having a bit of humor about it and in the situation as well, rather than trying to be preachy about it or anything.
Yeah. It's also quite clever because they've actually put disclaimers on their buckets. So it says lick fingers at own risk.
I didn't see that. That's classic. That is good. And then last one of my quick fire at the top, but I was listening to a podcast with Brian Chesky, who's one of the founders of Airbnb, and they were saying that they took 12 years to build their business up, and they lost 80% of the value in 8 weeks this year. And here's something that they cut $1 billion of planned marketing. Now, from my side of things, I didn't realize that these tech companies like Uber and Airbnb spend that kind of money on marketing. You almost have the sense that it's viral. It just kind of happens, and because they don't own any of it, they people just find them. But they had planned $1 billion of marketing that they cut to save some money. I mean, were you guys aware that these guys are spending that kind of money? I see Uber ads all over the place as well, but that's a lot of money.
Yeah, I would say once you start thinking about it, you go, yeah, they are quite often on TV and they're all over, you know, my YouTube ads and wherever else. So I guess it makes sense. It might be those sort of companies where they did come up through virality that we then just assume everyone knows them from that virality. But to then start getting to the wider market, they're putting up ads for those people that aren't early adopters, aren't up on the tech, slow adopters of it. So it doesn't quite surprise me. It's obviously massive numbers, but I can start to figure out why or where it might be going.
Yeah, and I think a lot of startups that I've spoken to or worked with in the past, they always say, you know, whenever they're looking to raise funds from investors, often anywhere between 40 and 80% of their use of funds is projected for marketing. And I think right now, I mean, everything's so saturated. There's so many businesses, there's so many eyeballs through social media, there's so many different platforms and online. I think that's the best way to kind of, you know, bring awareness to your product. If you don't have awareness, however great it is, you're not going to sell it. So There's just so many avenues for now. So I think everyone wants to push money into, you know, ads and marketing.
And last one on Airbnb in this thing, he was saying that in that time when they were going in this big dip, they raised $2 billion in 72 hours in the middle of a pandemic, but based on their plans on how it's going to come out at the end. That's $2 billion in 72 hours. And it's just, for me, those kind of numbers, again, is phenomenal. But what goes back is that they actually, when they launched Airbnb, they wrote and pitched to 20 investors before, and none of those 20 bit. And it's amazing how sometimes when you're a startup, you think it's just going to happen like this, and that it's a good idea, and people are going to see it, and you just get this kind of funding. But they got 20 no's before they got a yes. And now they can raise $2 billion in 72 hours.
Yeah, I think it's easy to, once you've proven and everyone else is doing it, there's a bit of FOMO and stuff that I imagine starts to kick in with investors that don't want to be risky and so forth. We help startups obviously raise funds and have seen what it's like when they come to us. And even if we've vetted them and think it's a good idea, and you know, we cull off a lot of companies that were just letting your business plans off, your financials are off, go away and work on it. And then we go speak to investors. And even then for us, it's still hit and miss. So I imagine for them going out directly, I think that's just part of the game for startups. And to get out there, you're going to have to hit your 20, 50 VCs and angel investors and get all those no's to get the one yes.
Yeah, the very early stages when it's the highest risk. So you go in then, I mean, especially with angel investors, they're putting their own personal money in there rather than institutional funds. So that's, you know, you'd probably get a bigger share if you go in early, you take the risk, you know, risk it for the biscuit. once it's been validated a bit more and a few people have put their money in, it makes people feel more comfortable with revenue coming in. So it's easier to raise funds later on in the cycle.
Yeah.
I haven't had a chance to check it out yet, but I did see also on Airbnb, though, the founder was talking about very much that this is a time that can create a pivot or like can create a company out of this rather than just bunkering down. So they've been going a lot harder on online experiences and so forth. I didn't get a chance to look into it, but he dropped some like big names of people that were doing these online experiences that you can now buy through Airbnb. So it's got nothing to do with property.
He was saying, so he said this, and by the way, if anyone wants to listen, it's How I Built This by Guy Raz. That's the podcast that I listen to. But he was saying that they back up to their numbers. So they dropped 80%, but year on year, July, because that's when that podcast was recorded, they're actually very similar to last year. But people are using Airbnb within 200 miles of their home, and they're finding that the kind of places are cabins and you know, what do you call RVs? They're actually renting out RVs now as well. They're saying that they're wait lists for those kind of things. So it's interesting how they're shifting as well from sharing a bed in someone's home to all of these other things.
It makes sense. No one wants to go to a hotel where there's going to be other people. You just want a house to yourself. So the little staycations we're taking to get out of our houses, we still want to go to somewhere that's ours or private.
Another thing, and it leads into one of the things we actually came here to speak about, is the fact that, you know, normally on the ad, when you're looking at Airbnb, it says there's will be Wi-Fi, and now people are putting up their speed. So it's becoming it's becoming such a factor because people are working from home and they So wherever they're staying, they want the right speed. That one of the factors that you now put on your ad is internet speed. Not just I have Wi-Fi, it's how fast is your Wi-Fi, because I might choose another place with faster Wi-Fi.
It's a good point. And especially once you got multiple people start connecting and need to run video chats, it's a factor for sure.
Yeah. And it kind of, we were going to talk about the kind of, you know, with everyone working from home, what makes a really good home office? And what do you guys think? And already given away my thought, because that is that the speed of your internet is by far the most important thing of a home office, in my opinion.
Yeah, I think I agree with that. I mean, if you nowadays we're all communicating online through video, so that is crucial. But then obviously there's been a lot of interesting background activities when you're working from home. So I think your environment's important. I mean, some funny ones are when you get to see people's bedrooms or their rooms and they're on the video chat and you spend more time looking at their home environment than you do listening to what they're saying.
So I blur the background.
Yeah. What have you got in the background then?
Yeah, you do. Bedroom. I think it depends on, well, obviously environment's the big right word there. But like, for example, I'm in central London in a not too big of a place. So I don't have a separate area. And I've sort of gotten to the point where I've popped back into our offices a couple of days a week occasionally. There's no one there and all the safety stuff's in place, which is good. Just because working in the same space, I then have to sleep or sit around and watch movies. There's a mentality there. So I think if you can have a separate area, so I'm actually also looking at other places at the moment. And one thing we're taking into effect is, can we get a place with an extra bedroom? Because then we'll probably make that an office where me and my partner can set up some desks and it will just be a separate place where we can go work, make it look nice, and then come away from it at the end of the day and sit and watch TV in a separate room and obviously have the bedroom separate. So that would, I think, be what's ideal. It'd be interesting to see, because I know some companies are also going, well, the money we're not spending on an office, we can allocate employees 50 quid or something just to do up their home space, you know, whether it's buying some little pot plants or so forth. I think that's an interesting way to look at how you do it. Because also I was thinking if I have to end up being in my house for a longer term, I probably need a better chair at some point as well, because this one will do for a little while. But then do we go, well, great, we're not in the office anymore. Would you guys mind forking out for a nice chair for me while I sit here all day and work away? So I think environment's probably the key, and Wi-Fi.
There's also, before COVID, there were already people doing work from home options. And a company that I worked with, one of the criteria was that you must have a door that can close. So if you want to be allowed to work from home, because it was optional at the time, you must be able to have a place where you can close the door. You can't have an open plan kind of, I'm sitting at the coffee table, but someone's cooking and everything else. So I think it sounds weird, but that is crucial. You guys don't have kids, but I've got little kids who they really battle with the doors closed. You can't come in, you know. Luckily they're at school now, but when they, you guys know that sometimes they kind of pop in and say, but it's kind of, that's one of those things where, again, in a home office, ideally, a place where you can kind of keep your, in check like that.
Yeah, and that's a good point by Ben on the chair thing as well. I spent the first 2-3 months with this kind of small lounge chair digging into my back, and then I was like, I really need to buy a new chair. And then I found this one in the garage. I was like, oh, it's so much more comfortable. That was a good find.
Yeah, because I think, you know, we do ergonomics at office. We do ergonomics of, you know, desk height and seat and your environment and the light. And then we should be taking that into consideration in our home office as well.
Yeah, it'll be interesting to see how people progress, because obviously at the start, we didn't know how long it was going to be. So people just made do with the chairs and so forth. And now it's, as I said, because we're looking for a place, it's more of a consideration of, oh, if we can get an extra room, that will become an office, and we would have never worried about that beforehand. And even if we start going back into the office, it's still nice to now know we have an office space because we'll probably have the option to work from home if we want to. And then so I start thinking, oh, I might get one of those desks that can raise up to a standing desk and go back down and so forth. And then what's going to make that nice? I guess that also leads on a little bit to what do you guys think the future of the actual office will sort of be? Because we've got some co-working space, and that's where I've been popping in and out of. And that kind of seems to be making sense. A lot of people seem to say like the WeWorks and so forth are going to die now, but I'm wondering if those are going to be the models that slightly flourish from this, because large companies aren't going to want to pay for the office space they previously had if a quarter to half their staff are working from home. So do you just need a co-working space where you can check in, check out when you need to work somewhere else, rather than have a permanent large office that can take 100% capacity of your staff? What do you guys think?
I think it's going to be, I think you're right. I think people like, or companies like WeWork, I mean, before coronavirus, before lockdown, WeWork itself was kind of suffering, had the whole kind of debacle with its investment rate or going public and the value of the company and fraud. But I think whilst offices were hit initially, I think you're right, more co-working style spaces will probably do quite well out of this. And actually beyond that, there are a few companies that are popping out, one we've worked with actually, that they're trying to offer kind of flexible co-working, like multiple office space. So you can subscribe and actually you can then work in lots of different co-working spaces. You're not tied to the exact same one. So that gives you even more flexibility. And I think that's quite important in times like this. So those sorts of co-working spaces will probably thrive, if anything, because I think it'll get to a point where, even though a lot of people love working from home, it's got to get to a point where some people, there'll be a divide. Some people will want to be back in the office, some will want to go part-time, some will want to stay at home. And something like this gives you the flexibility to kind of cover off all of those different needs.
But maybe one of the biggest things that will change is the contract, right? So a lot of leases that you landlords want to sign you up for 3 years or something. I have a feeling people will just say that time is gone. That's kind of, I'll sign a month on month, or I'll sign 6 months or a year max. Other than that, I worry, or I just don't think people will be taking 3-5 year leases anymore.
Oh, they're going to be very specific about break clauses within that. So when if this cycles back around or something, that they've got a way out of their rent and of their stuff, and putting pauses on it and so forth.
Yeah, but Ben, you were chatting about looking for a new place. It kind of, we were chatting earlier leading into this, that property prices in the UK are kind of skyrocketing. One of the reasons is that there's a big influx of people from Hong Kong who are trying to run away from that government regime, and the property prices are spiking. Have you guys felt that, or what do you feel like it's happening in the UK, and is it a good or a bad thing?
I think it's interesting, because earlier in the year, there were a lot of predictions were made that house prices are actually going to go down. It's going to become a buyer's market. And obviously we've gone into recession as well. So you'd think, oh, would property prices go up? So the timing with the kind of deal on inviting giving a route to citizenship for Hong Kong citizens and fueling that demand for property prices has kind of kept those prices high. So it is an interesting one. It'll be interesting to see if that continues. But I think there's other factors as well. So with the demand from Hong Kong, you've also got, as like Ben was mentioning, you know, people want to think about, should I create an actual more longer term space? So depending on if you live in central London, do you now want to move to the country? Do you want a bigger house? Do you want a garden? Do you want those things that, you know, you've kind of realized that's more important than being in a smaller place in a central London where it's easy to commute to work, because you might not be commuting to work as much. So those things have probably also fueled demand for people to buy properties and raise prices.
Yeah, it would be interesting to see like a heat map of where that demand is, because I think, like Zane said, you probably find it might even be a little bit quieter in the city and more on the outside, because we can work from home now. If I had to only come into the office 2 days a week, then I'll probably accept a little bit of a longer commute than if it was 5 days a week. And then if I can get a nicer space, if I've got a garden now, because I'm going to be at home all day, nice to get outside and so forth. it'll change. So yeah, we've been seeing an increase in demand, obviously, with helping Hong Kong people move their business over into the UK, and we help look at some of the property and so forth. A lot of the areas they're looking at are just on the sort of outskirts, Sutton, Richmond, those sorts of areas. No one's really talking about being in central London or anything, and then they just want to know about the commute. They're looking for safe schools, safe areas. So that's where it's sort of going up. I think so. It's an interesting one. I had a friend who was in the process of buying a house as we sort of went into lockdown and so forth. And then they tried to renegotiate based off assuming that the market was going to go way down. So they went to try renegotiate, and the real estate agent was being very stubborn about it. And they were going, well, surely the house prices are going to change. They ended up settling on the original amount because they just weren't seeing that much fluctuation. So I think maybe if you're in an urgent case of needing to sell the house, there's some negotiability there. But yeah, I think it's interesting that it's going up instead of going down in these times.
I kind of looked into this, and it's interesting what rising housing prices can also do, which I didn't really think of it too closely. But the kind of stuff that higher property prices allow is, firstly, if you own a home and the property prices are going up, your overall sentiment is more positive. And then you start to spend more because you know I'm valued more. So the overall sentiment increases. Your overall spend increases because you know if you lose it, I've got more of a house to sell. Banks start lending more because their assets that they own are worth more, so therefore they can lend more. These are quite things that you don't necessarily figure out that it's all tied in. The rising prices mean that your stamp duty when you're buying a house means that more money comes into the government and your fiscus goes up. So there's quite a lot of things tied into it. That all of these things are interlinked, that it's one of those age-old things again, rising tides raise all ships. And maybe that's also what's happening here, is that the property prices go up. Yes, you might think, oh, it's really tough because if you're the one buying into a higher property prices, but the overall economy rises as well.
Yeah, that's an interesting point. I didn't really think about it like that. But then based on the stamp duty point you mentioned as well, so Rishi Sunak, the Chancellor, he cut stamp duty temporarily for properties up to £500,000. So that's probably also had an impact in, you know, people being able to save money on tax by purchasing properties. Now, I think it lasts until April 21. And I've actually got a friend who recently moved house. He bought a new build, which wasn't going to be ready until August. So now it's just about being finished. But he was selling his existing house and the new buyers really wanted to move in. And they were pushing and pushing for it. And obviously for them, they would rather stay in their house until the new build was ready, but you know, they had to move. And funnily enough, went and stayed in an Airbnb, so that also helped. And what actually happened was, because those buyers who were so kind of keen to move in, they moved in before the stamp duty cut came in. So if they'd waited another month or so, they probably would have saved £14,000-£15,000, which my friend has done with his new build, and he's just used that to spend on a new gym. So, you know.
There you go. And it's also one of the other things I didn't mention is that when the property prices go up, the construction industry goes up, and that just adds to the overall GDP. And there's more money in the fisc. There's more money in the cycle. It really does go. But the cutting of the stamp duty is interesting. How there's so many different things that just think about what's happening in the UK is being affected by the Hong Kong political environment, but is also then being spurred on by the cut in stamp duties, and it kind of all, then there's a COVID crisis pandemic happening that says maybe I need new housing. And yeah, it's amazing how everything is interlinked when you look at this.
Yeah, everything's interlinked. It's all kind of often even unintended consequences can happen with any decision you make. So with the stamp duty one, I find it interesting. So the government's saying we're going to cut stamp duty, so that's less tax coming into them. But then they decided, let's change the London congestion charge. So it's now Monday to Sunday rather than Monday to Friday. I think it's 6 a.m. or 8 a.m. to 10 p.m., whereas before it was like 8 till 5. So basically, it's impossible to drive in London with, and they raised the price to £15. So they're saying, yeah, you shouldn't take public transport. You should stay kind of away from people. But if you do want to drive, it's going to damage the environment, and we're going to charge you loads to do it. So it's like they're kind of raising money through that, they're taxing people in that way, but they're not taxing people in other ways. It's a bit confusing.
I wonder if that was in the pipeline already and they just stuck with it and didn't adapt that strategy for COVID. It's like, we were already going to try and reduce traffic in London before all this happened, and they just, yeah, stick with that one. It'd be difficult to say we're going to encourage more cars in central London as much as they want to say don't travel. But yeah, I wonder if they'd stay away from it. It was really nice to have a quiet London in lockdown. I really enjoyed walking around the streets, to be honest. Started feeling weird once traffic was back. So I'm pro congestion charge as I sit here without a car.
talking about cars, and that's a nice little transition into my next thing I wanted to raise. And that's, did you guys know that if you're in the market, by the way, Ben, if you're in the market for a Porsche, you can now subscribe to a Porsche, and then you can change whatever you don't have one car. You have a fleet of cars that you can use. And today I need a Cayenne because I've got my family and I need to drive around. But on the weekend, I'd like a 911, you know, just because I'm going out with my wife. And you just go in and swap it. And you never own it. It's a complete subscription model to Porsche, the brand, and you can move that. What do you guys think of that?
Sounds awesome.
It sounds awesome. Anyone in the market? I'm not in the market for one, I must tell you. But yeah.
Yeah, I'd heard of like car clubs and stuff, and probably here as well, but in the US, I think I saw it on Suits, to be honest. And the idea is like you can have a different car on the weekend, but they're, you know, super like Mustangs that are all done up as well as the high end. So it's like you kind of just book which car you want for the weekend, depending on what red carpet you're pulling up to and whatnot. But I guess it makes sense. It'd be similar to subscribing to like a Zipcar and so forth, where you just want to grab what's available. But then, yeah, it makes sense to almost do it with a brand or for a brand to come out and do it. It's going to almost be similar to the sort of taxi fleet subscription idea for Uber, where you just book the next car, I guess. I wonder what the distribution's like, though. Where do you get it from?
Yeah, I didn't go into the details. I was kind of I was on a different podcast around subscriptions as a business model, where they were saying that any business can be a subscription model. Any business. Yeah. What do you guys think about that? And then the pros and cons of a subscription model.
I mean, I think it gives people so much more flexibility, which is important these days. So especially with coronavirus, but even before lockdowns, you know, people want that kind of option of, I want to consume something. I want options. I want unlimited choice, but I don't want to have to pay and go to a checkout every single time. So if I can just pay that monthly recurring fee and I get all these different options, and then I can cancel at any time or after a set period, you know, that gives people kind of more value for money almost, or even at least a feeling of that.
Yeah. I think with cars, it makes a lot of sense, and I'll come back to the overall question, but because the car's a depreciating asset, constantly things to worry about, like checkups and so forth, that makes sense to like take that out of the factor and for me to go, well, actually, you're solving a bit of a problem for me. Sure, I'll pay. And because you don't really think about if I buy the car and own it, because there's always a question with other things of like owning versus renting and so forth, right? With a house, at least you'll be able to sell it for a higher equity at a later date, but a car loses value. So is it the same as just paying a subscription for a couple of years? You cut it, you've lost that subscription money, obviously. You got a service, but you never really think about selling the car, I guess. Maybe you do. The only thing I would say with subscriptions, I think there's certainly things that benefit from it. One thing I get conscious of, though, is how many things I end up subscribed to. And then it starts to add up really quickly. So I get very conscious of, like, by the time I pay for a gym, Netflix, Disney Plus, Spotify, like, it all starts adding up very quickly. And I think that's part of why the subscription model works, is because a little monthly fee here doesn't seem like much till it all adds up. But then I start to wonder, how much is it for the year? So even like a VPN service, 10 quid a month seems fine. But then if I said to you, 120 quid a year for you to have a VPN on your phone, do you want to do it? You start questioning it. So
what they were saying was that there's a subscription regret or something like that, they called it. And that's when you're not using all the services. So if you subscribe to something and you're not using all the services, then people go, do I really need it? But what's nice about subscriptions on both sides is the predictability, is that the business can predict their income. They're not having to sell all the time. And as a consumer, you kind of, even if you have 10 subscriptions, at least you know exactly what's coming off your salary that month. The interesting thing is that they were talking about unusual subscriptions. So one of it is there's exterminator. So the exterminator even has a subscription. So you pay. Yeah. So you're not paying to come and kill this bug now.
Yeah.
You just want no bugs. So you pay a subscription and every month he pitches up and goes, what's bugging you? You know? and he just cleans it up so that you never need to worry about that. And that made me think that's actually what you're buying, right? You're not buying the guy to come and kill a bug. You want no bugs. And if you do a gym membership, you're not renting a treadmill. You're just trying to be fit. So it's kind of I want a subscription to be fit, and it's therefore up to you to upgrade your equipment so that I'm put new classes in the gym and do different things so that I stay fit. Yeah. You're buying more than that, but it's one way to kind of have lifetime value when it comes to subscription. It's kind of, how do I provide lifetime value to this client so that I don't spy, then ignore you for a few years and try and sell something else to you? It's just a consistent relationship with the brand.
Yeah, I think that's the key. Yeah, it gives you as a company an opportunity to kind of build up that brand loyalty. You bring somebody in, as Ben said, you know, that kind of psychology of, £10 a month compared to £120 for a year. They come in and they think that's not too much of a commitment. And once they're in, for a subscription service to work, I think that the company offering the subscription needs to spend as much, if not probably more time focusing on the users it has than on acquiring new users, because the new users will follow anyway. And the more you enjoy that experience, the more you're going to have a longer term relationship. Because as you said, you join because you want to be fit. That's why you join a gym. Or, you know, it's all about that experience. And the better the experience you can deliver, the more likely you're to keep those customers, and those customers will be happy.
I like your exterminator model. And I was trying to think of what I would do to make that work. And because you might not need a monthly debugging from an exterminator, but what you could do is
have in Australia or something.
Yeah, we just get used to them there. Don't worry about it. You could have a small subscription fee that adds up to, so say it costs 100 quid for you to normally get an exterminator to come around. You pay 10 quid a month, and you get at least one visit a year, but you can use it whenever you like. Maybe you get two. They would do the math and the model of how often someone needs it. But you could kind of build up that knowledge of, when I need it, I can just call an exterminator. I don't have to pay anymore. I'm sort of covering it. Exterminator might be an odd one, but imagine even like a handyman. You pay 5 quid a month to a handyman, but then when you need him, he comes in, sorts it out, and it's done. And you've got two bookings a year you can use for no extra cost, or there's just a small surcharge on top to like cover the difference if you get him a third time or something. And then, so things that you would maybe not necessarily, like, you got a little bit of a broken door, normally you wouldn't do it, but because you've got that handyman on retainer, essentially on call, then maybe you'd use it more often as well, because you know you've got that service available to you because you're paying this little monthly subscription. So there could be different ways in lots of different markets of.
Do you think a restaurant could be a subscription model? So if you're a cool restaurant and I subscribe to it, and there must be some value, but that means I get a table and I can come and eat there once a month or once a week, and I have my table and I can do it. Can your hairdresser be a subscription model, so that I want to get my hair cut, but then I'm not due for a haircut, but I've got a function and I want to look really nice, so you go in there. You know, these are just like, can subscriptions work for everything?
I mean, hairdressers people go into relatively regularly anyway, so they're almost on subscription. The only thing that you'd maybe benefit is retention of people going to different hairdressers. If you make it cheaper or something, but then you know I'm going to come back to that one because I'm already subscribed. I'm not going to. But I don't know. There's obviously different markets there between men and women. You and I might go very different periods. Like one time I might get a haircut in a month, and then I might wait 2 months and get a haircut. Whereas girls are probably a little more regular in some of their stuff anyway. Restaurants, I guess maybe. One of the thoughts I had during the lockdown was because pubs need a lot of funds to get back open. So my mate owns a pub. His mum owns a pub, and they said, like, just to reopen the pub as soon as they can, they've got to restock, they've got to get food in, they've got to get staff in. So there's a decent cost there. He's saying like $5,000 to $10,000 to open the door. And obviously these businesses have been shut for months, so it's not a small amount. And I was wondering if then what you could do is try to get locals to support that, but in return they get discounts, they on all the drinks and everything, that maybe they get a free beer each month, like it comes back. It's almost like buying a share in the pub, and you get these little benefits, dividends of it. So maybe that's where the subscription comes in. I pay my pub £5 a month. They have that regular. It also means I'll probably go there to do all my drinking because I get 10% off. So I'm not going to go to the pub down the street. Maybe I get preference in booking a table or preference in food or special offers.
Would that tie you into that pub only? So for the next year or 2 years or however long, you have to go to the same place. Was there a risk of you getting bored of that? Or
do they know your name there when you walk in? Do they go boom?
I don't know. I guess some people just always go to the same pub. That's what a local is, right? And then you can still go out for dinner other places, but it's your more casual standard drinks. I don't know, I guess it's difficult in maybe in places like London as well, where quite often you're going all over, and if your friends don't live around you, you're quite often meeting in different places. Whereas in smaller locations, quite often, like back home, we'd always meet in the same two or three pubs max. So if one of them had a benefit over the other, it'd be an easy choice just to go to that one. I think everything could come up. I think it's what do you subscribe to? What's the service? What's the benefit? Is then becomes a question if you want to make it subscription. You got to make it seem justified.
There was a legal tech company a few years ago that came up with legal subscription services. So you pay your monthly fee and you can call upon whatever legal services you need. The lawyers are there on demand. And it sounded like a fantastic idea. I think they got hundreds of millions of investment or something along those lines. They did really well at the beginning. And then it turned out that the customers were just like, yeah, I need this, I need this. And there were so many lawyers that had to do all this work, and then all of their salaries had to be paid. The company actually went bust. So it was a good idea, and they got a lot of backing from investors, and it didn't work out. So, I mean, I think subscriptions are potentially the future for a lot of industries, but maybe certain ones, maybe it'll need a bit of refining. Maybe it can work, but hasn't necessarily worked for certain industries to date.
Good. Well, at least with coffee with Centuri, you don't have to pay a subscription fee to watch us. But
not until we come up with the right idea.
So I think that's it for this week. Please, if you are watching and you're enjoying it, let us know. Drop us a line on what you think we should chat about. Come and join us. We'll invite you in. We'll have coffee with you as well. But thanks, guys. I think that's a wrap. Until next week.
Thanks. Till next week.
Cheers, everyone. Bye.